So Fiona Watt, I don't think needs too much introduction. She's somehow one of the grand dames of stem cells. She's been extremely important in the whole field of understanding the epidermis and skin stem cells. I read some of her more recent papers and put them in my lectures, actually. And it's really extraordinary how much she's achieved in this field and showing, you know, that where we just thought things were probably relatively simple in the epidermis, in fact, there are many different lineages. And it's thanks to her studies that she's really pinned them down, the different types of stem cells, the different dynamics they have, the different cues they have, the signaling pathways that are used. So I have to admit, Fiona, I'm a huge fan of your work. I'm very impressed by all you've achieved in your career. But aside from all that, you've also achieved an awful lot else. You've set up institutes, you're running the MRC, and you're also a fervent proponent of STEM and have been very active in the ISSCR as well. So it's really a huge honor to have you here, and we're all looking forward to hearing you. So over to you.
Thank you, Edith. And it's really sad not to be with you in person. I love London, but Paris must come a close second to great cities of the world. So as Edith told you, we've been working on skin for a long time. And in this talk, I'm really going to tell you about some very old experiments that we've done in the lab and how we get the chance to reinterpret them through the availability of new data from single cell RNA sequencing. So that's the journey that I want to go on this afternoon. So to introduce you to the skin, it's an incredibly simple structure. Essentially, it's got two layers. The outermost layer is called the epidermis, and it is separated from connective tissue called the dermis by a specialized extracellular matrix called the basement membrane. So I think you can probably just see this faint pink line separating the epidermis from the dermis. And I've always been interested in the ongoing process of differentiation in adult tissues. And so for me, starting out, the epidermis was a really exciting system to work on. And that's because if you just look at it, you can see that it's made of multiple layers. And the layers closest to the dermis have got nuclei, but the outermost layers are dead cells. They don't have a nucleus at all. And as everybody knows, when you rub the surface of your skin, you're constantly shedding dead cells from the surface of the skin. And by and large, you never run out of epidermis. So this is one of the classic tissues, like the blood, and you heard the intestine from Hans this morning, which was appreciated to be maintained throughout our lives by stem cells. And we know a lot about the different layers of the epidermis, which is shown schematically here. So the stem cells, which power the renewal of the epidermis, lie attached to the basement membrane. And cells that leave this layer no longer divide, but they undergo a series of changes in gene expression and morphology as they move from the basal layer through the upper living layers to the dead outermost layers. And this journey time in most body sites takes about a month. And although these outermost cells are dead cells, they're incredibly important because they act as a physical barrier to protect our bodies from invasion of pathogens and also from water loss. So for a long time, I've been really intrigued to find out more about the stem cell compartment. And the starting point for me was when I had the privilege of being a postdoc many years ago with this man, the late Howard Green. And he had shown with his student, Jim Reinwald, back in 1975, that you could take a biopsy of human skin, disaggregate the epidermal cells, and plate them out in a culture dish with a feeder layer of 3T3 cells. And if you left them, they would form individual colonies of cells. They would form multi-layered colonies. And over time, these would expand and merge with one another to give you a multi-layered epidermis on a dish. And Howard, in incredibly quick time, was able to show that if you took a cultured sheet of epidermis and grafted it back onto the original donor, in this case, a man who'd suffered a burn injury to his arm, then this cultured sheet of epidermis could provide a permanent replacement for the epidermis that had been lost. So again, this is one of the classic stem cell treatments, which is still in use today. So being interested in what the nature of the stem cells was, I decided to use this assay of colony formation as a cell culture readout to count stem cells. And other groups have done this in different ways. Some of you will remember Jan Barenden, who worked in Paris for a number of years, then in Switzerland and now in Singapore, Michele De Luca. And essentially, we count the colonies in different ways, but we've all used colony formation as a surrogate readout for stem cells. And this just shows you several dishes of our cultured epidermal cells seeded at clonal density and grown up. And in this case, we used it as a way to screen different batches of medium to see which ones were best at supporting the growth of the cells. So many years ago, armed with this assay, we decided to look for cell surface markers that would allow us to enrich for these colony forming cells. And the first marker that we found was that these stem cells or clonogenic cells express high levels of extracellular matrix receptors of the integrin family, the beta 1 integrins. All cells in the basal layer of the epidermis express integrins, but we found that the most highly clonogenic cells, the most adhesive cells, had the highest levels of the integrins. We went on over the years to find a number of different markers. And with the integrins and other markers, such as the one shown here, we see evidence that the cells expressing stem cell markers are not randomly scattered in the basal layer of the epidermis, but they form clusters, as you can see here. Another stem cell marker that we found early on was I forgot to tell you that when integrins were first described by people, many people thought of them simply as passive anchors of the cell to the basement membrane. But work from many different groups, and this is an old review from Richard Hines, have shown that the integrins signal very actively to promote a number of different essential cell processes, including proliferation and, in our case, differentiation. And we and others have shown that in the case of the epidermis, signaling through ERK MAP kinase is absolutely essential for the cells to remain in the stem cell compartment. So as I started to say, another marker that we found early on was that the stem cells express high levels of the Notch ligand delta-like 1. We found this actually because our neighboring lab at the time were Drosophila geneticists, and they were very excited about human homologs of Drosophila genes like the Wnt pathway. So we worked with them to see if our epidermal cells did indeed express a conserved delta-like 1 gene. And the answer was that they did. And to summarize a lot of work that we did, relying primarily on delta overexpression, we have a model whereby the stem cell clusters express high levels of delta-like 1, which is shown here in yellow. And this not only helps maintain the stem cells in the stem cell compartment by inhibiting differentiation, but it also instructs neighboring cells that they should differentiate. And we also found that in a kind of notch-independent manner, delta-like 1 promotes cohesion of the cells. So really fascinating protein, which is much more than simply a marker of clonogenic cells. We and others over the years have looked at a number of stem cell markers, but more recently we turned our attention to a different process, and that is shown in this schematic here as the process of commitment. So by that we mean cells which are still in the basal layer of the epidermis. They haven't yet embarked on the differentiation journey upwards, but nevertheless, they've made the irreversible decision to exit the stem cell compartment. we had absolutely no markers of commitment. So a few years back, we turned to a classic Howard Green experiment, which had allowed us to define an experimental system in which commitment occurred. And that is shown in this slide here. So if you're growing cultured human epidermal cells, and you make a single cell suspension, disaggregate them, and hold them in a semi-solid medium, which prevents them from attaching back to the culture dish, you can see in quite a fascinatingly reproducible series of events that they go from being undifferentiated cells with expressing the stem cell markers like beta-1 integrin through to differentiated cells. And in this case, at 24 hours, or in fact before, they've expressed this marker called involucrin. And if you leave the cells for another 2 or 3 days, they will form that endpoint cornified cell, which represents the end of the differentiation process. And what we found many years ago was that at 4 hours in suspension, even though the cells are still expressing stem cell markers, here are a couple of examples shown by qPCR. This is alpha-6 integrin and the transcription factor P63. Even though these markers are still expressed, these cells have lost the ability to form colonies if you replate them in culture. And just for completeness, here are a couple of our differentiation markers. You can see that at 4 hours in suspension, they haven't yet increased. So in a fantastic collaboration with Angus Lammin's lab in Dundee, we set about doing a systematic bulk gene expression profiling and proteomic profiling to look specifically at what was special about cells at 4 hours in suspension. And we published this about 3 or 4 years ago, so I won't take you through all of the evidence. But what we found was that this 4 hour time point in suspension was characterized by a very large number of protein dephosphorylation events. And that led us to become very interested in protein phosphatases. We found that of the 248 phosphatases in the human genome, 22 were upregulated at this 4 hour time point as our cells were committing to differentiate. And we found some of them through our proteomic analysis, and actually a lot at the RNA level. So just to illustrate that, this is one of our stem cell markers, P63. This is qPCR. You can see the levels are pretty steady between 0 and 4 hours, and then they decline. And then here are three of the protein phosphatases, which go up transiently in suspension and then go down again. So obviously, we've done a lot of different experiments to try to get at the function of these protein phosphatases. But one of the most informative experiments was actually the initial screen. And here what we did was to do a transient knockdown individually of each of the protein phosphatases. And then we carried out our colony forming assay to count the number of stem cells. And in this spider diagram, each blue circle represents 10% of the cells forming colonies. So our scrambled controls are shown here, this dish in red. And in this experiment, the scrambled controls, about 22% of the cells form colonies on plating. Then if we transiently knock down the individual protein phosphatases, you can see that in some cases, there's quite a strong effect on colony formation. So I draw your attention in particular to DUSP6, where you see a big increase in colony formation. And another example here would be PTPN13, where again, you get this big increase. So our idea was that if at the time of commitment, these protein phosphatases are upregulated, they will serve to help cells out of the stem cell compartment and reduce their ability to form colonies. So we argued that what we were looking at was a network or of pro-commitment phosphatases. And as I say, if you're interested, a lot of the further experimental evidence for that is now published. We were very fortunate to notice when we knock down expression of one protein phosphatase, that often it had an effect on expression of another. And furthermore, that this interaction changed with time in suspension. So collaborating with Sarah Jane Dunn, who was then at Microsoft in Cambridge, we applied her Boolean network analysis to our experimental data. And we came to the conclusion that this commitment in suspension is inherently unstable. And the interactions between the individual protein phosphatases act as a commitment switch between two stable states. So we see the stem cell state as being stable, the differentiated state as being stable, and the commitment state as being unstable. And as you've seen in our experimental data, we would argue that this unstable state lasts for about 1 or 2 hours. Now, we were excited about identifying the protein phosphatases, but we knew that they negatively regulated ERK MAP kinase amongst other kinases. But we wanted to be able to look at commitment more dynamically at single cell resolution in living cells. And we were able to do that because my then postdoc, Toruhiro Tsuka, who's now a group leader in Kyoto, had done his PhD with Michi Matsuda in Kyoto. And Michi has made and validated a wonderful selection of FRET sensors, including this one here, which you can introduce into cells, and it will give you a readout, very sensitive readout of ERK activity. And furthermore, it reports in the nucleus, which is very convenient for us because our differentiation markers tend to be expressed in the cytoplasm. So to complement the work that I've shown you already, we decided to look at individual cells undergoing differentiation to see what was happening to ERK levels and also what the impact was of the protein phosphatases. So this shows you one of the experiments that Toru did. We put the FRET sensor into our cultured human epidermis, and we also introduced a fluorescent M-cherry reporter under the control of the involucrin promoter. So that's our differentiation marker. So that meant that in individual cells, as we could monitor them over a period of hours as shown here, and we could correlate ERK activity with whether or not the cells switched on the differentiation marker. And this shows you 4 individual cells that we monitored out of hundreds or thousands. And what we noticed in each case was that the upregulation of involucrin was preceded by a period where ERK activity was pulsatile. So the frequency of the pulses, the amplitude of the pulses was not stereotypical. All we could say for sure was that prior to the onset of differentiation, we'd see pulses of ERK activity. And then, as others had seen, once the cells actually had started to differentiate, ERK levels tended to go down. And we were really fortunate to be able to collaborate with Ignacio and Gunnar, two mathematicians who really helped us to model the experimental data. So what happens if we turn on our 2 of our pro-commitment phosphatases? What happens to ERK levels? Well, here again, we had our cultured human epidermis. We had our ERK FRET sensor. And now we used doxycycline inducible vectors to overexpress DUSP6 or DUSP10. And it was really fascinating to see that both of the phosphatases affected ERK, but in different ways. So in this case, if we upregulate DUSP6, we see no effect on mean ERK levels, but we see a dampening down of ERK pulses. Conversely, with DUSP10, no effect on the pulses, but we see a decline in ERK activity levels. So to summarize a lot of work which we published last summer, this is the model we have of how cells are exiting the stem cell compartment. In the stem cell state, we see the cells as having high stable ERK activity. We then see a transition to pulsatile ERK activity. If it's pulsatile on a basal high level, the cells can actually return to the stem cell compartment. They might proliferate, for example, and then go back. But if the pulses are taking place and mean ERK levels are low, then the cells will irreversibly differentiate. And as I've said, we're seeing different effects of different phosphatases on the dynamics of this process. So I've told you so far the work that we've been doing with cultured human epidermis. Our studies indicate that there are multiple populations of epidermal cells or keratinocytes in the basal layer, that transient upregulation of protein phosphatases trigger the onset of differentiation. And I've also told you that when early on we found the Notch ligand delta-like 1 as a stem cell marker, we could see that it was having different effects in basal cells and differentiated cells. So we now move right fast forward to the present day, and an initiative which I'm sure you've heard of, spearheaded by Sarah Teichman at the Sanger Institute and Aviv Regev at the Broad, which is called the Human Cell Atlas. And this is essentially a global initiative to map all of the cells in the human body. And I know that there's some fantastic initiatives based in France, as in other countries, working on this. I was really excited to get involved in this because it's pretty obvious that if you know what all the cells are in the body, it's going to be highly likely that you are going to find out important new things about normal physiology, but and also about disease mechanisms. And as our lab has worked over the years with collaborators who've got expertise and insights that we could never have ourselves, I really do believe that collaborating, sharing data, and integrating data sets is the way to go. So our part of this effort has been funded by the Wellcome Trust, and it's a project led by Sarah, looking not just at skin, but in a number of other tissues. And the skin work is a fantastic collaboration with Maz Hanifa in Newcastle, and this great team at King's, headed up by Magnus Lynch. So this shows you, where we've got to in work that we just published a few weeks ago. So what we have now is a data set of more than 500,000 cells from human skin. Instead of just isolating cells from the epidermis or the dermis, we have data for all of the different cell types. We've also got data from healthy adult skin, from patients with atopic dermatitis or psoriasis, and we have also a number of samples of developing fetal skin. So you can imagine, this is just a goldmine, very exciting for us. The slight problem for me is that Maz and Sarah are immunologists. So they talk about CD45 negative cells as though those are the cells that you would naturally throw away. And we've learned a lot from interacting with immunologists, but what we have done very recently is focus particularly, obviously, on the epidermis. So CD45 negative epidermal cells. And we simply wanted to know, is all of this work that we've done over the years just a big artifact in vitro? Or does it stand the scrutiny of single cell analysis? A lot of people in my lab have contributed to the analysis, but I would particularly like to highlight Victor Negri, who made the UMAP plots for the five samples of healthy adult skin epidermis that I referred to. Now, because people have worked on the epidermis for so long, we're very confident about what constitutes a basal cell or the differentiating layers, because we have lots of antibody markers. And in the UMAP plots, we're really, really pleased to see that Victor could pull out three distinct subsets of basal cells. So, of course, we wanted to have a look at what markers distinguish these cells. And as you can see here from the plots and also from this way of showing average expression, within the three basal cell populations, we can find all of our favorite stem cell markers. So the beta 1 integrins, most highly expressed in basal 3, delta-like 1 in basal 2, another pair of markers that we've worked on over the years, caveolin 1 and caveolin 2 are there. Now, the big challenge for us at the moment is to understand whether these three subpopulations of cells are functionally distinct and whether or not there's a hierarchy in their properties. We don't know the answer to that, but one thing that I think is important to bear in mind is that different proteins have different half-lives. And through Angus Lamb and our collaborator in Dundee, we know for a fact that the half-life of beta 1 integrins is significantly shorter than the half-life of the caveolins. And this probably goes some way to explaining why by flow cytometry, we would see, for example, that CD46 and beta 1 integrins are actually co-expressed. So there's a lot of work to be done now, and it's really about trying to understand the relationships between these different populations of cells. Now, what about commitment? Again, we were really, really happy when Victor took a look and he said, yes, there are two populations of cells which represent a transition between the basal cells and the suprabasal cells, and he's named them here transition 1 and 2. So where are our beloved protein phosphatases? Well, I'm pleased to say they're in the right place. So DUSP6 you can see here, and DUSP10 here. And the fact that DUSP10 shows a broader distribution than DUSP6 actually maps really well with our original qPCR experiments, where we'd always seen that the peak of expression of DUSP10 in culture is at several hours longer than the peak of expression of DUSP6. So this is exciting. Again, it gives us some other aspects of the interactions of the protein phosphatases to look at. And then the third category of genes that we wanted to look at in the data set were the Notch ligands, our favorite one, DLL1, which I've shown you already, but there are multiple Notch ligands and receptors. And we knew from work from a number of groups like Freddie Ratkes and Paolo Dotto's that the Notch pathway does very interesting and complex things in different epithelia. So what we have so far here is a map of the different components. You can see very dynamic expression. And the only thing that I wanted to highlight particularly here is that delta-like 1 is not expressed at high levels in the epidermis. We have struggled over the years to detect it, for example, with antibodies. And most of our functional studies rely on overexpression. But as we started looking at these other components of the pathway, we realized that in the case of Notch, it's not just how much ligand is expressed, it's what are the modifications which are taking place in the Notch receptor. And in particular, we were very interested in genes which are called fringe genes. Now, these are N-acetylglycosyltransferases, which act on Notch receptors. And in particular, it's known that lunatic fringe increases the affinity of Notch for delta-like 1. When we looked in culture, we saw that lunatic fringe is by far the most abundant of the three fringe genes. In fact, we can't detect manic fringe at all. And then if we map that to the single cell atlas data, you can see sure enough that lunatic fringe is expressed at quite a high level. And it's also in that basal 2 population where delta lies. So does this mean anything? Well, this is possibly the first example of where we've used the single cell atlas data to go back and design more in vitro experiments. And what Victor did was to overexpress lunatic fringe and carry out our colony forming assay. And what you can see very clearly here is that if we overexpress lunatic, we expand the stem cell compartment. So those are the bulk of the experiments that I wanted to tell you about this afternoon, but I really can't stop presenting unless I give you a taster of where we're going to with that other compartment of the skin that we're interested in, and that is the dermis. And I freely admit that for many years I thought the dermis was boring. It was a bunch of collagen fibers that supports the bulk of the skin. But about 10 years ago, working in mice, we began to realize that the fibroblasts, which are responsible for making the extracellular matrix, are incredibly diverse. And in this very, I would say, flamboyant schematic that was produced for us by Science magazine, you can see some of the different kinds of fibroblasts that we and others had defined in the mouse. So there are cells at the bottom of the hair follicle that control the hair growth cycle. There are fibroblasts that turn into smooth muscle and control whether the hair follicles stand erect on the surface of the skin or not. We've got the cells that give rise to the fat, and we've got a number of other kinds of fibroblasts. So, of course, with the Human Cell Atlas, we wanted to know, are there different kinds of fibroblasts? And if so, are they functionally distinct? So this map shows you all of the different cell types that with Maz and Sarah, we've been able to identify. The epidermal cells, melanocytes, lots of different immune cells. But if we hone in on the fibroblasts, in this data set, there are three main populations of fibroblasts. We actually think, if you look in other data sets as well, the total number might be more than three, it might be five, but they're definitely three main populations of cells. And so what we are working on now is to try and to find out what their functions are, and whether we might be able to harness those, for example, to improve or resolve scar formation in the skin. Now, we can't do elegant experiments with transgenic mice if we're looking at human fibroblast function. But what we can turn to is an old assay, which I believe was developed by Marcel Prunieres, a very famous French dermatologist, a long time ago. And the assay is as follows. You take a piece of surgical waste human skin, you remove the epidermis, and you kill off all of the cells in the dermis by irradiation and repeated cycles of freezing and thawing. You then take this decellulized dermis, or dead, put it into a little well that you can see here, feed the culture from below, and then layer on top of the dead the epidermal cells, the keratinocytes. And you can see when the keratinocytes grow nicely, you get a nice dry surface. And in the absence of keratinocytes, it remains damp. And what we found is that we can inject different populations of fibroblasts into the dead. And we can use the effect on the epidermis as a simple assay for the function of different kinds of fibroblasts. So just to give you a sort of snapshot of some of the things we found, we've been able to confirm, using the markers that we found by single cell RNA sequencing, that there are indeed distinct populations of fibroblasts in the human as in the mouse. This is an example, a collagen six subunit, which this is antibody labeling, is very, very tightly restricted in expression to the cells just underneath the epidermis. And here's another marker, CD36, which is completely absent from the upper dermal fibroblasts, but is enriched in the lower dermal fibroblasts and also in the fat layers. And if we do our skin reconstitution assays, you can see that when we inject the CD36 positive fibroblasts, they're not very good at supporting epidermal growth, in contrast to another population of cells that express this marker, CD39. So we feel that there is good evidence that there are different, functionally distinct populations of fibroblasts in the skin, and that we might well be able to use that to restore the skin in some ways. So I'm just coming to the end of my presentation, but the predictions from our studies on mouse skin were that we would find multiple populations of fibroblasts with distinct functions, and we've been able to confirm that. We also knew from our fibroblast work that there were different populations are distinguished by the activation status of the Wnt pathway, ECM production and remodeling, and chemokine signaling. And we've been able to confirm that. And also we've been able to get some candidate new mediators of functional heterogeneity. So just to summarize, I'd like to thank you again for listening. Our conclusions are that the single cell RNA sequencing has confirmed the existence of multiple populations of epidermal and dermal cells. They've provided a reality check for our beloved experimental models. And they are already giving us new insights into skin physiology and also the changes that take place in the skin with benign inflammatory diseases, particularly psoriasis and atopic dermatitis. And the collaboration and data sharing has been really good. I mean, I think early on in the Human Cell Atlas initiative, there was a feeling that you would need to analyze maybe 20 age and site match skin biopsies to get a true picture of cellular heterogeneity. But in fact, if you look at anybody's data set, which is published or just on their computer, you can see that in essence, the same cells are present. And I think that's hugely positive because it really puts power into the hands of wet lab biologists. Once they know how to understand the data, they can use any data set that is freely available to help with their designing of their experiments. The last slide is very important. It's a huge thank you to my lab. This picture was taken in Christmas 2019. We're going to cautiously have a game of rounders in a couple of weeks, but working remotely, working in shifts has been really tough, and this crowd have been absolutely fantastic. So with that, I'll stop sharing and I'd be happy to take questions.